Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. One of the threats that we have been wrestling with aggressively and now for several years is, well, I think the result of a biological warfare attack against America. It is known as the COVID-19 pandemic. Those of us who are of a certain mind believe it was brought to us by the Chinese Communist Party. And we have been trying to figure out both the origins of this disease and its implications for our country, our society, and our freedoms ever since. A man who has been at the very forefront of that effort, both to protect our public health and to defeat the Chinese Communist Party virus, and frankly, those who have been exacerbating it rather than preventing it, is our first guest. I am beyond ecstatic to say we have him. He is much in demand these days. His name is Dr. Robert Malone. If you had central casting send in a medical doctor to help work through this particular problem set, you could hardly find a man better equipped to do so. He was one of the inventors of the mRNA technology that is in use in these vaccines for the CCP virus. He has decades of experience working on both infectious diseases and controlling them, defeating them wherever possible. He's worked for the Defense Department, NIH, and others in our government at the highest levels. I think he has properly understood to be one of the leading doctors in the world on infectious diseases. He is a prominent figure in several groups of doctors that are working this problem now in large numbers, notably ConcernedDoctors.org. He has also been a driving force behind the Unity Project. We're going to talk to him about a number of his good works, and not least his book about Lies My Government Told Me and the Better Future Ahead. Dr. Malone, thank you so much for joining us and for being really a champion for all of us in this very difficult moment. And we appreciate your leadership more than I can say, and also your visits with us from here to time to time.
Well, thanks, Frank. You know, it's always my pleasure, and I get a lot out of talking with you, too. So I'm a little embarrassed by your run-in, but let's go.
Okay, let's roll. Could you give us, in a short few minutes, sort of a level setting on how you see where we are with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic at the moment? Is it still with us? Has it essentially been defeated? Are these vaccines still something that people should be injecting, particularly into their young children, as we're being told is the case?
So let's take it back to front. Should the vaccines be used at this point? There's a consensus declaration that I and many other physicians had read that comes from the International Alliance of Physicians and Medical Scientists. So this is 17,000 people that are all physicians or medical scientists. It's all been vetted. You can find our website at globalcovidsummit.org, and you can find our statement there that we put out two Mondays ago. One has to, as you search on your favorite tool and browser, I suggest Google is not your friend for this search. Because Google manipulates the rankings and specifically manipulates rankings relating to us, you need to be cautious. The White House has basically stole our name and created a parallel website and name a couple of days after we launched ours. And then they've appropriated it and they've run their own global COVID summits, most recently, I think, two Thursdays ago.
It is very confusing. I do want to commend you for what you and your team put together. It is the most impressive very short course on what we're confronting at the moment and what we should be doing about it. And just complete your thought on what the bottom line is with respect to the vaccines and the pandemic itself.
Yeah, so the bottom line is that our group has come to consensus that the vaccine is no longer justified. The genetic vaccines are no longer justified because the currently circulating Omicron strains have a very low risk. It's been evaluated by the Panda Group, for instance, out of South Africa, that the mortality risk for those under 70 who are otherwise healthy is about 1 in 10,000 at worst, and that is without early treatment. So if your physician or you as an individual employ early treatment using the wide variety of drugs, now both licensed specifically or under EUA, repurposed antibodies, et cetera. So any competent physician that is using an early treatment strategy can knock that down far lower. And many of these docs that have been using repurposed drugs, even with the prior strains, have seen cumulative mortality in their case series of thousands. It's down as a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent. So even without Omicron, so we have a much less pathogenic, more highly infectious virus now currently circulating. And we have early treatment, and the vaccines are clearly not fully safe, nor are they fully effective. They are not stopping infection, replication, or transmission, which would be the normal definition of a vaccine. I hesitate increasingly to use the term vaccines for these genetic modification, gene therapy-based products. I think we need to modify our language a little bit. I think vaccines is not specific or appropriate. Let's call them inoculations.
So jabs, I guess, is the layman's term for it. Yes, but not doing the job and having real risks associated with it.
They aren't. And they are not fully safe. And we've seen that also increasingly documented. And we now learn that Pfizer has known that that was the case for quite a long time because of the forced disclosure by the courts of their underlying pharmacovigilance documents. So in short,
Which they had hoped to keep on ice for 75 years.
So, our consensus that took over a month to get to is, among other things, the vaccines are no longer justified by risk-benefit ratio. The public health threat is akin, it's in the realm of that of a seasonal influenza, which also takes out historically the elderly and those that are infirm, let's say, for some other reason that are at high risk, whether they have cancer or pre-existing genetic disease or whatever. So the risk is more akin to influenza in the case of Omicron. The risk of the vaccines are considerable. They are not trivial. The vaccine's effectiveness in doing what vaccines are supposed to do, preventing infection, replication, and spread, is clearly failing. And we have the emerging data from all over the world, including now from the CDC in the 5 to 11 cohort, that not only are the vaccines not preventing infection, replication, and transmission, but they appear to have what is called negative effectiveness. That's kind of a euphemism, if I can give you it in straight talk. The vaccines are correlated with an increased risk of infection, disease, hospitalization, and death. That's paradox.
Not something you want your children particularly to be afflicted with. Doctor, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Malone and lies your government has been telling you about all of this right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden today explicitly declared that the United States would defend Taiwan in the event it is attacked by communist China. As has happened before, however, the White House promptly walked back that statement, reestablishing the sort of official strategic ambiguity that at this point can only invite such Chinese aggression. An even further inducement to the Chinese Communist Party's belligerence is a move afoot in Washington and on Wall Street that would result in U.S. military personnel and other federal government employees helping pay for it. The Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board is holding a public meeting tomorrow morning, and all other things being equal, it is expected to greenlight the investment of their thrift savings plan accounts in mutual funds that will include CCP companies, even sanctioned ones. Join us in opposing such underwriting of our mortal enemy at notspforccp.org. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back, and again, a very special welcome to Dr. Robert Malone, a personal hero of mine, and I think for millions of Americans and others around the world, for both his straight talk, as well as his clear-eyed diagnosis of the problems that we're facing in the form of this, biological warfare attack, my words, I think appropriately. Let me just ask you, sir. You have been critical not only of our own government and what Tony Fauci and others have been telling us about, the nature of the disease itself, the origins, the characteristics it has in terms of its transmissibility, what we can do about it with masks and so on, and the effectiveness of these vaccines, the safety of these vaccines. But you've also been very critical, and I think, again, properly so, about the World Health Organization. I'd like to ask you a little bit about it and its performance thus far under this Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General, and the prospect now in the offing that the powers of the World Health Organization to declare public health crises, emergencies of international concern will be greatly expanded at the expense of our sovereignty.
I believe that's the case. There's two pieces of, I hesitate to call it legislation, political action, let's call it, pending right now that are about to be further discussed, including in the context of a visit by the executive branch of the United States. Let's tee that apart just for a moment. What we have are the international health regulations of the World Health Organization is one topic area. And the other topic area relevant to what you're saying is the pending treaty to be negotiated with the World Health Organization by the United States. And there is often discussion in the use of language about whether or not the U.S. currently has a treaty with the World Health Organization. To the best of my knowledge, there is no such treaty. There has never been a review or vote by the Senate to approve a treaty, quote unquote, between the United States and the World Health Organization. There is an agreement. We provide capital to them, and you'll recall, of course, Mr. Trump decided to stop providing that capital to the World Health Organization, and then it was rekindled by Mr. Biden when he came to office again. So again, our taxpayers are funding the World Health Organization to a very significant way by using borrowed money, just to be clear on that, right? We're borrowing money to send it to the World Health Organization, and you and your children will be paying back that loan.
Right. And borrowing it, I think it's probably fair to say, from the Chinese, who actually seem to have control of the World Health Organization under this Dr. Tedros, further exacerbating concerns about, as you say, these amendments that, and I'm so glad to hear you say that you can't find any evidence that the Senate ever actually formally considered and approved this arrangement. I couldn't either, and I wasn't sure whether I just wasn't finding it in the right places. But it's unbelievable when you think about the power that's already entrusted to it.
Yeah,
based in particular,
it's crucial to run that to ground because the administration current, let's say current administration, I could use various pejoratives, is using the language as if there is an existing treaty, but this is political posturing and wordplay, to the best of my knowledge. So now we've divided this into two things. There is a pending treaty, which the Senate will get its teeth into, and I doubt it will meet the criteria for ratification. So many of us think that is not a current threat to our national autonomy. And then there is these backdoored modifications to the international health regulations that have been proposed by our good friends at HHS. And it's hard for me to imagine that this does not have Tony Fauci's fingerprints all over it, since he basically sits at the top of that pyramid. There is no way that this could have gone to WHO without Tony's authorization and active participation in. So we, as I think,
And this would, of course, be the same Dr. Fauci who had provided funding to the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program to develop, through gain of function research, the virus in the first place. I mean, this is just
going back to plain talk. I think this is a very clear example of the HHS tail wagging the presidential dog once again. And once again, we see Dr. Fauci at the center of this, in my opinion. And what this is another example of the unelected deep bureaucracy, we call this deep state, as basically making policy for the United States. And in this case, compromising U.S. autonomy and sovereignty, in my opinion.
And in your opinion, you would strongly oppose these amendments being, in fact, imposed upon our country and with the effect, I guess, of having Dr. Tedros able to tell us what constitute these public health emergencies and what we can do about
it. And this is also the opinion of the World Council of Health for Health, which I'm here in Bath at their Better Way conference. Which just completed, and in an hour, that's why we actually can't talk too long, is I have to go to their operational meeting and strategy meeting about what we can do globally to resist the implementation of these IHR modifications.
We don't want to keep you from that important task. That's vital. And again, the leadership that you're exhibiting in many of these organizations, the 17,000 doctors, is exemplary and so deeply appreciated, sir. Just very quickly, before I let you go, you have described the sudden interest in and worrying discussions about monkeypox as fear porn. Could you just give us a quick 2 minutes on what this disease is, where it stands now, and why it is not something that we should get, again, back into lockdown, the China model, as Tedros and others have called it, that has done us so much harm, again, to our society, our people, and our freedoms.
So regarding the, let's start high level, monkeypox has been around probably for centuries, if not millennia. In Africa, it's a misnomer. It doesn't just reside in monkeys. There's a variety of animal hosts. There was a prior outbreak in the United States that some of you may remember, probably only the wonks like me that are in the biodefense space may remember, with some imported small rodent-like animals from Africa that were brought into the United States and infected prairie dogs who were susceptible to monkeypox. And so there was a prairie dog-based monkeypox outbreak in the regions of America, like Colorado, that have indigenous prairie dogs. And we handled that just fine. And it was actually fairly widespread, and there were a number of cases. We already have stockpiled smallpox vaccine, for which there's no smallpox, but which cross-protects against monkeypox. That's in the stockpile. And I am perplexed as to why we had to borrow another $119 million and drop that into purchasing yet more smallpox vaccine for what is essentially a minor at best threat. It has a reproduction coefficient of less than one. Now, all this is predicated on the thesis that this is not an engineered monkeypox. But what I'm hearing again and again from the field, there is some rumblings from press that are, again, kind of scare or fear porn articles that it may be, so it's purely speculative, it may be engineered, but all of the intel and information I'm hearing is this is the least of the two circulating clades in Africa.
Dr. Malone, I am so sorry to have to cut you off, sir, but you have to go and so do we. This is really important stuff. I hope you'll come back to us soon with updates. We need your help as always. God bless you, sir. Next up, Gordon Chang on the latest from China.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our wonderful, regular, duty expert, Gordon Chang, when it comes to matters involving China, the Western Pacific, well, the free world more generally. There's nobody better. Gordon is, of course, the author of, among other things, The Coming Collapse of China, an essayist of great renown, notably these days at places like the Gatestone Institute and Newsweek. He is also, of course, a man to be followed closely at Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, which I'm proud to do. Gordon, it's always good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back, especially on a very, very busy day in your agenda.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let's start with what broke the news this morning, which was the president once again, when directly asked the question, will the United States defend Taiwan in the event of an attack by China, said, without hemming or hawing, without a lot of caveats, yes, we will. Now, there was some talk both by him and most especially by the White House subsequently that seemed to kind of reinsert a little bit of that old strategic ambiguity, as it's called. What are we to make of where we stand at the moment, do you think, and how the Chinese are perceiving it?
Two things, Frank. Clearly, the president wants to defend Taiwan. He believes it is our commitment, as he said. And this was not an isolated statement. He said this to George Stephanopoulos last year. He said it to Anderson Cooper at that town hall on October 21st of last year, and he said it now. So clearly that's his instinct. But in all three of these instances, the White House has walked back that statement. And whatever one thinks of the commitment to defend Taiwan, and I think that's a terrific thing the president has said, there is this disarray in the administration. And the Chinese are going to look at that and probably think that they can get what they want because they don't believe that the U.S. will, in fact, defend Taiwan. This is a dangerous moment, and I think that the administration needs to come clean on this, say in a way which is unambiguous, which is not contradicted, what its policy is. Because if we don't do that, then I think the Chinese are going to look at this and think that the United States is incapable.
Or at least irresolute. Gordon, we had a program last week featuring members of this very important product from the Center for Security Policy. I think you're familiar with it, Stopping a Taiwan Invasion. Dr. Stephen Bryan was on the program. We had also a webinar sponsored by our Committee on the Present Danger, China, in which strategic ambiguity was really one of the foremost recommendations that has to be dispensed with in favor of, well, basically what the president said, and more to the point, backing it up with some specific concrete actions. I guess if we've learned anything from the Ukraine debacle, it is you want to protect people, arm them, give them the capability to defend themselves before they're attacked, not after the event. Your thoughts on that general proposition?
Strategic ambiguity worked, but it only worked in a benign period, and we're no longer in a benign period. So we do have to move to strategic clarity. And I believe the President of the United States should do a number of things. First of all, he should get behind the Resolute desk in front of a TV camera and say, the United States will defend Taiwan. And he should also say that the United States will offer a mutual defense treaty to Taipei if it wants it, that we are willing to recognize Taipei as Taiwan, if Taipei wants it, that we are willing to ship weapons on an emergency basis to the island, and that we should base American troops there as tripwire. In other words, what we do in South Korea, which has worked in seven decades in a far more dangerous situation than the one in Taiwan. If we do that, we can maintain peace and stability. And one thing, Frank, especially now with the war in Ukraine, we cannot afford another war on the other side of the Eurasian landmass, because that really means the end of peace and stability everywhere.
Right. So deterrence needs to be shored up. And I think your recommendations, Gordon, make a lot of sense. They're very much consistent, I think, with the thrust of these recommendations from a really distinguished expert panel, including former commanders of the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force and Marine forces in the Pacific. I'm very proud of this. Your point about engaging and really endorsing Taiwan as a sovereign nation, unfortunately, has been further I think, moved at arm's length by a decision by the administration in the context of this new trade pact. The Taiwan will be dealt with bilaterally, but not in this sort of multilateral context. Talk a little bit about that, Gordon, the nature of this trade pact, how it relates to the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, and specifically the advisability or inadvisability of leaving Taiwan out.
Yeah, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework it does cover trade issues like, for instance, labor standards, environmental standards, supply chain resiliency, but it doesn't deal with market access. So it's not a full trade pact. And therefore, it sort of lacks a lot of specifics. I wanted to see Taiwan invited to join the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which deals with trade matters, but really is not a trade pact because it doesn't include market access, which is clearly the most important thing. I think that the administration did not invite Taiwan because it wanted the maximum number of countries to join, and there are 11 others. And some of those countries would not have been comfortable being in an agreement that included Taiwan. But having said all that, the United States needs to bolster its trade relations with Taiwan, And however we do this, with a free trade agreement or some other way, we need to show Beijing that we're not afraid of it.
Gordon, let me ask you about another diplomatic fandango that's underway in the midst of all of this in Asia. The president will be meeting in the course of the day today, as we're speaking, with members of the so-called Quad. This would be Japan and India and the new prime minister of Australia, so newly minted that he basically had to rush from, I guess, his election victory party off to be at the Quad meeting. Give us a sense of what the lay of the land is now with respect to this group, what it possibly could mean in terms of that idea of deterring aggression against Taiwan, and also this new prime minister. What do we know about him in Australia?
Yeah, the Quad is really important, and it is bipartisan. It is one way to contain China, and Australia is part of it. Now they've got a Labor government, first one in 12 or so years. We don't know what their policies are going to be. I tend to think that they'll be same as the previous government because Anthony Albanese is moving towards the center on defense policy. But the question is going to be the AUKUS pact, the pact among Australia, the United States, and UK for, in the first instance, the production of nuclear-powered submarines. So there's a lot that we really don't know at this point, Frank. You know, in terms of the Quad, though, it is almost not so much a question of local politics as really the Chinese pushing everybody together. There would have been no Quad were it not for Beijing's provocative policies. So that means that countries that might waver in normal times, I think, are going to be fully on board. And that, of course, includes Australia.
Two quick questions, Gordon. Is the Labor Party opposed to this submarine deal? And secondly, is India among the countries, obviously, that is pulling alongside? Do you think that that would be so, including in the case of an attack on Taiwan?
There have been murmurs in the Labor Party that they didn't like the AUKUS pact, but I don't think that that will actually affect policy. But that's just a mere guess. At this point, I don't even know if the Labor Party knows what it's really going to do. And with regard to India, India has, of course, been squishy on Ukraine. But when it comes to matters on China, there's no question about it. I mean, there are Chinese troops on Indian-controlled territory. That really defines things. China killed 21 Indian troopers in 2020. There's no question that India, when it comes to China, is all in. And I'd expect India to support Taiwan.
You would. Well, that's very heartening because obviously having that major power on the subcontinent of Asia aligned with us, not just in sort of the abstract, but in a very practical way, has to bear on Chinese calculations. And again, this was another important recommendation out of this expert panel study, Gordon, was the vital need to present China with a united front on the part of various allied nations, including, of course, Taiwan, rather than making it look as though either Taiwan is on its own or that the United States is not going to have its partners. Gordon, I think we're going to leave it at that for today. Thank you so much for your time and Godspeed, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with the great Douglas Murray about the war on the West. That and more, straight ahead. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden today explicitly declared that the United States would defend Taiwan in the event it is attacked by communist China. As has happened before, however, the White House promptly walked back that statement, reestablishing the sort of official strategic ambiguity that at this point can only invite such Chinese aggression. An even further inducement to the Chinese Communist Party's belligerence is a move afoot in Washington and on Wall Street that would result in U.S. military personnel and other federal government employees helping pay for it. The Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board is holding a public meeting tomorrow morning, and all other things being equal, it is expected to greenlight the investment of their thrift savings plan accounts in mutual funds that will include CCP companies, even sanctioned ones. Join us in opposing such underwriting of our mortal enemy at notspforccp.org. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and it's my pleasure to say we are joined by one of the world's most prominent and, I think, most interesting public intellectuals. His name is Douglas Murray. He is the author of seven best-selling books, including a brand new bestseller entitled The War on the West. I'm fascinated by this topic. We spend much of the time in this program addressing various pieces of it, and I can't think of a better person to pick the brains of about it than Douglas Murray, old friend. Welcome back to Securing America. It's great to have you, Douglas.
It's great to be back with you, Frank. Thank you.
Congratulations on yet another pathbreaking book. Tell us about the war on the West and who's waging it.
Well, The War in the West is a culmination of several books I've been writing in recent years. The first of them was The Strange Death of Europe on Immigration, Identity, and Islam, which looked at the whole issue of migration in the 21st century and the way in which Europe in particular was just changing beyond recognition. Then I wrote a book called The Madness of Crowds on gender, race, and identity, which looked at the way in which Western democracies were strangely pulling themselves apart along lines of sex, sexual orientation, race, and much more. But I knew that I was getting to something, and The War on the West is a kind of culmination of this, because I've noticed throughout all my lifetime, Frank, as I know you have, that we've had a very strange tendency in the West where we go past the point of self-criticism and on to self-hatred, where we end up revering everything so long as it's not our own. Revering anything so long as we didn't produce it, and indeed doing down everything we did produce. And this is what I describe as Western anti-Westernism. Now, there's lots of different types of anti-Westernism, as you well know. I mean, there's Chinese anti-Westernism, there's African anti-Westernism, Middle Eastern anti-Westernism. But all of these are almost nothing compared to Western anti-Westernism. That is the desire of people in the West to think worst of themselves. And this is now, in recent years, caught the tone of a cultural revolution, particularly since the death of George Floyd in 2020. We're basically undergoing a cultural revolutionary moment where there have been people who've been working away in the academies and elsewhere since the 1970s, at least, since the 60s, you could say, to give America in particular a totally different view of itself. And in the last few years, this has sped up enormously. So that, for instance, the founding date of America now is said to be, by no less a paper than the paper of record, 1619. Why? Because it's important to make sure that the American story is changed from a story of heroism and achievement and glory into a story of shame and endless iniquity and slavery. It's the same with every figure from the American past. Just last November, in the council chamber in New York, the council voted for Thomas Jefferson's statue to be crated up, pulled down, and wheeled out the back door. Why? Because, as one of the members of the council said, Thomas Jefferson does not represent our values. George Washington has undergone the same attacks. it doesn't need to be said how many of the statues of Columbus have been pulled down in recent years by people who seem to think that it would be better if Columbus had never discovered the Americas and had returned home and said there's nothing much to see there, guys. Don't bother sailing out again. This has gone on everywhere, from the north side and the south side in the Civil War, a remorseless attack on everything in American and Western history.
And as you say, Douglas, this is part and parcel of cultural Marxism and the march through the institutions that has been, I think it's fair to say, our lot in life, not just, you know, watching it from afar in Mao's China, but very much in our own time. And destroying your history, destroying where you came from, destroying what those values and beliefs are is obviously central to it. So where does that lead when we talk about these, well, enemies, foreign and domestic? Are you saying that we're seeing adversaries fostering this from outside the United States? Is this a purely internal phenomenon or a combination of the two?
It's a very interesting question, this, because, of course, it's internally caused. It is people in Western societies who have particularly whipped this up. But of course, our foreign adversaries, rivals, and others find it enormously comforting and comfortable for them. I give an example in the book. In the book, I do four sections. One is the war on majority populations, particularly that is the war on white people in America, in particular, and in the wider West, which is just astonishing. The only form of racism of our day that's permissible. Then there's the war on our history, the war on our religion, including our secular inheritance, and then the war on our culture. But in between, I do these what I call interlude chapters, and one of them is on China, saying, basically, what is the rest of the world doing whilst we do this to ourselves? And I give the example, which you well know, Frank, I'm sure many of your viewers and listeners do, but I go back to something that happened at the UN last year. Last year at the UN, there was an International Day of Racism, Anti-Racism Awareness, one of those days at the UN when an enormous amount, of course, is achieved. And at this particular occasion, the new American ambassador to the UN, Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, used her time on the floor of the UN to talk about how racist her country, America, is. She talked about the fact that America was born in original sin, that, of course, there was George Floyd, that there was the Asian Spa massacre, which actually wasn't a racist hate killing at all, but she presented it as such on the floor of the UN. She remembered at the end of her remarks, the US ambassador to the UN, she remembered at the end of the remarks to say, oh, and there is, of course, racism in other parts of the world, for instance, against the Rohingya in Myanmar and against the Uyghur Muslims in China. Who was the next person up after she spoke but the Chinese Communist Party's representative, who stood up and said, America has no right to speak about China. It has no right to interfere in our affairs, because the Chinese Communist ambassador to the UN said, America today has done something unheard of in the history of the United Nations. Her representative has come and confessed her nation's guilt. So you have no right to speak to us. We have exactly the same thing happened with Antony Blinken. They love that we are tearing ourselves apart, and wherever they can help us, they do.
Urging it on. And I guess this is really the point that I want to come back to on the other side of a short break, Douglas Murray. And that is, if we are engaged in these confession or struggle sessions, if you will, how much further down this road are we as a practical matter? But I'm interested in your take on some of these other foreign actors, the jihadis, about which you have written brilliantly over the years, and the so-called globalists, the corporate elites of the world, Davos and elsewhere, how they come together against us and what we must do in response. That and more with Douglas Murray right after this. Welcome back. We are visiting with Douglas Murray, a brilliant analyst and chronicler of the challenges of our time. And his insights are now in some 7 books, including most recently, The War on the West, a, well, not surprisingly, extremely erudite, thoughtful, and vivid dissection of what we are facing at the moment that is, I would argue, transforming our nation from the exceptional one to, at least what we're being told by an awful lot of people here, an exceptionally bad one. And what it means that this notion, our self-criticism, if you will, is taking hold in that great Marxist, you know, Maoist especially, cultural revolutionary tradition. So let me ask you about these other forces that are at work. They clearly, Douglas Murray, have different end states in mind. The caliphate for the jihadists and the, you know, world order being transformed or reset for the globalists. And of course, the communists have in mind simply running everything. How do they interact, for one thing, against us most especially, and how do you see the end game sorting?
Well, I mean, the end game could be, if we don't wise up, that all these forces and others pick us over like a carcass in the desert. There wouldn't be much left because we'd basically eaten ourselves. You mentioned the Marxist issue, and this is a very, very important one because I don't think enough people realize this, that that there are people who are waiting with old answers to the questions of our era. What I mean by that is they are hoping that we deracinate and destroy everything in our past in the hope that they have the only answer left standing. I give a very vivid example of this in the book when I describe the way in which every Western philosopher of the recent, of recent millennia has been lambasted. Aristotle was described in the Washington Post a couple of years ago as the grandfather of scientific racism. He was guilty, among other things, of being admired by the author Charles Murray. In more recent years, every philosopher of the Enlightenment has been pulled down, sometimes quite literally. Voltaire's statue in Paris, gone. David Hume's name taken off buildings named after him in his native Scotland, all for the allegation of historic links to racism of some kind, or slavery, or colonialism, or all three. As I point out in The War on the West, who is the one historical figure who this has not been practiced on? Karl Marx. Karl Marx. Only last year, another statue to Karl Marx went up in his native Germany, paid for by no less an authority than the Chinese Communist Party. Now, as I say in The War on the West, in a section which I adored researching and writing, look at Karl Marx's private correspondence with Engels. Look at his public writings in the American media at the time. His correspondence is littered with the use of the N-word, usually hyphenated to the word Jew. He was profoundly racist, referred to people who were born of black parents as gorillas. He was unbelievably anti-Semitic, despite being of Jewish birth himself. He was profoundly on the wrong side in everything to do with slavery and colonialism and much more. So why has this not been done to him? When David Hume has been destroyed for one single footnote, why is Karl Marx allowed off? Because lots of the people who are pushing this self-destruction on us want us to destroy ourselves and then say, oh, well, we've still got an answer. This horrible idea we've been trying for the last 200 years, Marxism. Well, no, fine. If you're going to do it to everyone, do it consistently. And the one thing I've heard from Marxists since this book came out, and this fact that I've been going on about Marx's racism has come out, is that they say, the Marxists now say to me, well, Douglas, he was a man of his time. And I say, oh, like Thomas Jefferson, you mean.
Mm-hmm. He was, among other things, as best I can tell, a dead white male also. And that... indeed. Yeah. It is indeed. Let me ask you about a matter of, I guess, ideology and philosophy in part, but also I would argue very much a manifestation of this revolutionary moment we're in. Talk to us, if you would, about replacement ideology or theory or practice and the allegation that people are sort of making this up as an agenda that is driving in fact, if not the fundamental transformation, certainly the very considerable realignment of our electorate, as millions, if not many millions, pour across our open southern border. How does that fit into your overall revolutionary model?
This is, of course, a very live discussion at the moment, because there is a conspiracy theory element to this, which has very, very bloody repercussions, as we saw in Buffalo recently. There are indeed people playing with a form of conspiracy theory in this, and I have repeatedly criticized these people and critiqued them and exposed where I think they are getting things wrong. Renaud Camus, who wrote the book, The Great Replacement in French, I say that it is a conspiratorial book in many ways. I mean, he seems to see this as a deliberate drive. I don't see it as that. I see that the massive demographic transformation in Europe happened, first of all, in a fit of absence of mind. I chronicled that in The Strange Death of Europe. Understanding after misunderstanding of Western governments, like the German government, who thought the guest workers would return home, and of course who didn't. And in more recent years, there has been an element of the left. The Labour, there was a member of the Labour team around Tony Blair who said that when the British encouraged mass migration from 97 onwards, that he thought it had a sense of trying to rub the right's nose in diversity. That does happen. And as you know, Frank, in the American context, there are Democrats, and particularly in the media, who do say to white Americans, you're going to be the minority and suck it up, and this is great, and this is the future of our country. And there are even those who say this is going to be good for the Democrats, because we're basically replacing old white Republicans with Democrats. Now, here's the problem, and we have to quickly address this. But I must get this right because it's important. Massive demographic transformation is occurring in the West. It is not all a conspiracy, but part of it is. And there are people running with it and running into very dangerous corners. I urge those people not to do so, and I urge people not to whip them along.
Amen. We have to leave it at that. Douglas Murray, thank you for The War on the West, and as well as your other works. Thank you for visiting with us about it. I hope you'll come back to us for a longer one in the near future. Thanks to the rest of you for being with us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us do just that, and if so, that you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.